Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. If you're coming to the podcast for the first time, welcome. It's an honour to be in your ears. And I'd love to tell you all about my debut novel, Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. It's the story of Violet and what happens when she rebounds from a breakup by throwing herself willingly into a wild, sexually experimental world with both of her new bosses-to-be. It's a romantic comedy with jokes, hopes and orgies. There's a special signed edition available for Your Book listeners to pre-order from Waterstones, and pre-ordering it is the very best way for you to support the podcast. I know lots of you have pre-ordered it already, and thank you with all my heart. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Also, if anyone is looking for the perfect last-minute Christmas gift, I have a suggestion for you. Painfully British Haikus by Dale Shaw. Yes, that's our very own producer Dale. Painfully funny, perfectly observed poems about the frailties and indignities that make us great. Well, that make us, anyway. If you have any awkward Christmas Zooms in the diary, keep the haikus handy and read them out during the difficult bits. Now, I have loved today's guest for as long as I have been able to read. Writer, actor, and I don't say this lightly, comic genius, Dawn French. Dawn tells us all about her fabulous, frank and funny new novel, Because of You, and her upcoming appearance on our screens as Beatrix Potter on Sky One on Christmas Eve in Roald and Beatrix, The Tale of the Curious Mouse. We talked about literary families, perfect poems, and the comedy writer's secret weapon, Ladybird Books. I wanted to start with Beatrix Potter, and I know you're playing her at Christmas. I'd love to know what your relationship is with those Beatrix Potter stories. Did you read them when you were little, or have you shared them with your own children at all?
Well, that's interesting, really, because I definitely did have Beatrix Potter books. I can't remember who gave them to me or how they were in my room, but I definitely had a few. I think I had The Tale of Mrs. Tiggywinkle, and I think I had Peter Rabbit. But then I kind of forgot all about Beatrix, but I like the look of them. I remember reading them and finding them quite alarming, but liked them at the same time. And I think that's the great thing about her is, you know, it looks cosy and it looks cute, and it's anything but that. But weirdly, when I came to play this part for this film that's coming on this Christmas, I was looking in my own bookshelf that's in my office at the moment, and there was a little Beatrix Potter, and it was, what was it, The Tale of Mrs. Tiggywinkle. And I brought it and I thought, surely this can't be my childhood book. I can't have brought this with me through my whole life. And there in it is, it's on my 18th birthday. It is from my very best friend then, a chap called Nigel, who has become my gay husband, that, you know, who I've known since I was 9 years old. And he knew how much I loved Beatrix Potter and gave me that book for my 18th birthday. So I thought, oh, yeah, OK, Beatrix Potter has been in my life in many different ways. It was a sort of camp present, really, but in remembrance of happier childhood stories. So, yeah, so there is a connection.
Oh, what an amazing gift, and what a thoughtful thing, and how interesting that it, because even, yeah. I think books we love, I think it's really hard to hold on to things, isn't it, sort of as adults, and, you know, you move and life changes, and that obviously stayed with you the whole time. I'm not sure for Shane, because I remember loving Mrs. Tiggywinkle, but I couldn't tell you anything other than
She's a hedgehog. Is she a hedgehog?
Well, you know, I don't. She is a hedgehog. Yes, she is. And one of the reasons I know this now is that in this beautiful film that we've made for Sky, which is based on the story of the day, the real day that the real Roald, 6-year-old Roald Dahl met the 60-ish-year-old Beatrix, which I didn't even know there was such a day, but there were a few minutes where they met. And Roald wrote about this in diaries or some reference. And so my friend Abby Wilson wrote this film. But, you know, until it came to then, I haven't thought about Mrs. Tiggywinkle at all. But the genius costume designer on this film, who's called Jane Spicer, decided that every character in the film would be referenced to a character in either Beatrix Potter or in Roald Dahl's writing. So it's very subtle, but she gave me a kind of beautiful plum-coloured jumper. And it is the same colour as Mrs. Tiggywinkle's shawl. And if you look carefully at this film, Bill Bailey is in it, and he plays a gentrified dandy or something like this. Anyway, there's a chap that the very young Roald meets on a railway station. And without a doubt, all the references there are to the BFG. So, you know, that, and you can see, can't you, in Roald's writing, you can see Beatrix's influence without a doubt.
All that, because the story is so vivid, and the darkness. And I guess I think Roald Dahl's maybe a little more dark, but I forget. But you're so right. There's a real violence and drama in Beatrix Potter, and you think she's so cosy, but in a way that I think absolutely appeals to, you know, clever children.
Yeah. Well, Beatrix didn't have children of her own, and she was not interested in protecting children from real kind of rural truths, if you like. You know, rats definitely get their tails chopped off. Kittens are eaten by rats. You know, and if Mr. McGregor had caught Peter, he'd be in a pie, no doubt about it. You know, there is some violence in it. And I don't think she wanted to protect children from that. And I don't think Roald wanted to either. And in fact, I think Roald Dahl has even spoken in the past about how children have to face some fears. And perhaps through children's literature, that's the best possible way that they can. It's madness to protect kids from that. And I loved anything that was a bit dangerous and difficult when I was younger.
Do you have a favourite Roald Dahl book?
Well, I think probably the BFG is the one, because I always thought the BFG was a nice big West Country accent. So, you know, that's how I read it. And so, yeah, that felt like it related to me and my family.
Can you remember the first book that you really chose for yourself, or the book that you read alone and thought, this is absolutely for me, this isn't from a parent or a teacher, this is mine?
Well, I do remember. I mean, I remember being given books to read at school and stuff like that, and opening my eyes to that. I remember being read to brilliant books, you know, The Hobbit and all of that. But the book that I returned to as a kid was The Family from One End Street.
Oh, I love that book.
Do you know those books? And then there was a series of them. Eve Garnett wrote them. And they were just hilarious. And they were very much about a kind of family you'd want to be part of. You know, lots of kids, lots going on. I mean, it was all kind of trivial family life stuff and a few adventures. They were a bit like the Larkins, really. But they were a jolly, happy family. And I remember reading those books and enjoying sitting in my bed and reading them on my own.
Something I think about all the time is it's in one of the sequels, I guess, when they're at the Dewdrop Inn. And I can't remember the girl's name, but she's allowed to make custard with real eggs. And she's never
yes.
allowed to do that at home because of the waste. And, you know, there's not much money and there are lots of kids. And that she's the sort of miracle of being able to experiment in the kitchen, her joy of cracking eggs.
Yeah, how fantastic. I mean, you're right inside a happy, sort of functioning and flawed family. And I think that's what I related to in it.
Something I really, really adored about Because of You, and I loved that book, and thank you for writing it. And
thank you.
Like millions of people, you know, little cliche, I laughed, I cried, but I did. It's so interesting about mothers, but also about daughters. And I was wondering if there are any other novels or books where that dynamic has appealed to you. And I think it's always really interesting, because I think motherhood is something that we're good at exploring in book, that, you know, many writers explore quite readily and quite well. Daughterhood, I'm also fascinated by, and it's really interesting to see that, because I think that maybe comes up less often.
Yeah. I mean, the book that immediately comes to mind when you talk about mothers and daughters is Postcards from the Edge. You know, that was quite a book. And Carrie Fisher, that's it, who I met several times. She was a good friend of Ruby Wax's, and she is very funny. She came to my home, actually, and she named her daughter Billy, and my daughter's called Billy, and we had a bit of back and forth about that. And, of course, her mother was Debbie Reynolds. And that was a very open and honest book about a troubled relationship with her mother. Yeah, really on. And a look inside kind of Hollywood lifestyle, I guess, the likes of which, you know, I wouldn't begin to know or understand, the kind of parties her mother had and whatever. But this was something, when I think about it now, it was a book where a daughter has to take charge of a mother because the mother is reckless and drunk a lot of the time. And here's a daughter who also becomes reckless and drunk and has to try and understand the patterns of that, and attributes a lot of it to her mum, who she loves very much. And if I'm right, I think Debbie Reynolds died, didn't she, a few years ago, and then Carrie died just a few days later. It's almost like Carrie's heart was broken losing her mum. But that dynamic of mother and daughter is very similar to the dynamic of mother and daughter that's in Absolutely Fabulous, that I did not write, but that I was part of the very first sketch that we did. And really, that was the basic tenet of that sketch, was that a daughter has to mother the mother, you know, and the daughter might be the more straight-laced one initially. And that's where we started from with Ab Fab. So that's interesting. That's only just occurred to me. But yes, I love that book. I mean, my book is not about that kind of mother-daughter relationship, but you're right. It is about the kind of the power and the magnitude of mother love, which is something that I'm very interested in. And that, you know, I am a mother, and I'm a mother to two fully cooked new human beings that I inherited when I remarried. And so I now have a son, which I never thought I would have. And I've got another daughter. And I've also been a daughter, and I've been mothered magnificently by my mother. And, you know, it's only now in my 60s that I realise how well she did that job under all kinds of difficult circumstances, you know, right from the beginning, not having lots of dosh and travelling around a lot because my dad was in the RAF and, you know, going through all kinds of things. And even eventually, sadly, my dad took his own life when I was about 18. So my mum had to be mum and dad to me and my brother. And, you know, at a very difficult age. And I realise as well that when I think back, that I was pretty much allergic to my mother throughout a lot of my teens and into my early 20s, that just her nearness just annoyed me. Everything about her annoyed me. Her politics annoyed me, her opinions, the smell of her, the presence of her annoyed me. She made my skin creep sometimes, but I adored her at the same time. And we went through these very turbulent, difficult, emotional times together. And we rowed and we had these wars, and we were very, you know, we're both fairly strong women, and we were loud, and we were robust in our arguments. That's me being kind. But this was all in the surety that the scaffolding of that very important relationship was always, always in place, and that we would return to the peace and the forgiving of that relationship. Always, always. And that gave us the permission to have these differences. And I'm of the opinion, you know, that you're supposed to war with your mother. You're supposed to rebel against her, because otherwise, when the moment comes to tear away, which we have to do, and to fly the nest, you would die of sadness if you hadn't already had some rocky road, and if it wasn't a little bit of a relief to remove yourself from your mother's influence. But by the same token, you still want to be her baby, her child. You still want to, you know, crash out on her couch and have her cook you stew and look after you and pat your head and, you know, be there if you're poorly and all of those things. So in Because of You, I just wanted to take a deep dive, if you like, into what mother love is. And obviously that story has a curious start to motherhood.
Which is difficult, isn't it, to talk about Because of You, because I'm sure lots of our listeners will have read it, but for anyone who hasn't, I know that there are, I want them to be as surprised and delighted as I was. This is a clumsy half-cooked metaphor, maybe just half of a metaphor really, but what you were saying about mothers and you want to pull away, but you want to know your mum is there and it's always going to be there and you can always go and be a child. And I think that about the books I love. You want that universe to stay in stasis and be able to return to it whenever you need it. Thinking a lot about, I suppose, Pride and Prejudice as well, you know, Mrs. Bennet being arguably one of the worst mothers in a book of all time, but her, in a way, she's doing her job because all of her girls, out of sheer sad economic necessity, they've all got to kind of, you know, flee the nest and marry, and she is, you know, doing her best to make sure they really want to leave home.
Yes. You know, I remember whenever I read Jane Austen, which I loved so much, but I've never reread, actually. Whenever I did, I thought, oh, well, it must have been the way it was then. Mothers must have, for instance, in that book, mothers must have behaved like that to marry their daughters off. They must have had to be rather cruel to their daughters on occasion in order to do that. And then you have the realization, yes, that was the those were the manners of the day. However, look at this character. It's not just whatever happened. It wasn't just the norm, the social norm. It was also brilliant writing of a particular kind of overbearing person, beautifully balanced with Mr. Bennet, you know, and what genius writing. And I think you have to get a bit older to realise that, this, you've been sort of you've been mugged in a literary way into thinking one kind of thing, when in fact, of course, what's happening is human beings are being written about in all their glorious extremities. And Jane Austen loved an extreme character, and that's where the humour is.
I mean, I still think the funniest thing in any book is the best way to make a character funny is to make them pompous. And she's so good at skewering pomposity. But then, you know, seeing it later in things like Diary of a Nobody and even Adrian Mole, that's why we love those characters so much. You know, they take themselves so seriously, so we don't have to.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, pomposity and self-interest are great traits for any humorous character. I've tried to write a character in this book who's, although this book, the main event of this book are women, without a doubt, the men are very important to me. And anyone who knows me knows that I love a good dad, because I had a great dad. So I have written a good dad in this book, and I've also written a not so good dad. And the not so good dad, who's a bit of a narcissist, well, not a bit, a lot of a narcissist, and somebody with such giant self-interest where there's no room for anyone to love him more than he loves himself. That was a delight to me to write somebody, again, who is a snob, pompous, self-interested. Flawed people are where great humour can, it's a very fertile area, very fertile.
Now, it's at the time of recording, it's, I'm not going to say the C word this early on, but it is December. In general, what are the books that you love to give as gifts? Are there any particular books that you've given to more than one person and really sort of pressed into their hands?
Well, you know, it depends on the people, doesn't it? I've got a stepdaughter who's quite a feminist. So, you know, she won't see this. I hope she won't hear this. I don't know. She might. I don't want to ruin the surprise. But I've given Dr. Jessica Stevenson's written a great book about how women are forever looking for approval and blah blah blah. And I want to give her that. I've always given her Caitlin Moran's books. But my own daughter is a photographer, so I would give her books, you know, about Martin Parr or. Anybody, you know, Diane Arbus or Eve Arnold or someone like that. So it depends, really. I'm married to a man who does not read novels.
Oh.
And but does read books about trees.
Oh,
And books about wood and, you know, how to make axes and stuff like that. And it's an extraordinary thing, actually, being... I've never really in my life been partnered with anybody that didn't read fiction. But he doesn't, really. He just doesn't. As a lot of guys don't, as I discover. It was only when I came into the publishing world that I realised how many, you know, literary and popular fiction is, you know, supported by women to a huge degree, huge degree. Men apparently are very loyal to the authors that they like. They will always buy whatever somebody, you know, Ian Rankin or, you know, Forsyth or Bernard Cornwell or, you know, whoever it is. But women will try, you know, lots of things. But yeah, my husband doesn't read fiction at all, and I made the mistake when I first met him, whatever it was, 10 years ago now, that I had just finished a draft of a novel that I was writing, and I thought, this was such a huge present for me and such a huge risk to let him have a look at the first draft. And I gave it to him, and I said, I'd love your opinion on this, you know, because I thought, yeah, he'd be, you know, I love him and I would like to know what he thinks. So off he went with it. And I was waiting in my office and just, you know, rather nervous about what he might think of it. And then I heard him sort of singing. So I thought, oh, he seems distracted. That's not a good sign. And then I went into the kitchen where he was, and he'd literally read about two pages and was off whittling a spoon. I thought, okay.
Actually whittling a spoon.
Actually whittling a spoon, which is what he'd rather be doing. And it wasn't that he didn't want to read it. It's just that his brain is not the muscle that is his brain is not used to fiction. So he has to do it in little, very tiny little chunks. So giving him a draft to read will take ages. So I haven't done that since. I just don't do that. But yes, I would give people gifts that are suitable for them. And that's one of my greatest joys. And thank God we can get back into bookshops now, as of, you know, this week. Is to go into a bookshop with people in my mind and think, right, what is here? What delights are here that they would like? Shall I risk this new fiction, or shall I buy this beautiful coffee table thing, or shall I buy something funny or whatever? So I like doing that as gifts.
I was wondering whether you are a reader who really wants to gulp it down. I don't know about you, but if I love something, it's all I want to read, and I'm quite greedy and quite, I really want to be in the book. So, and I know there are readers like your husband who, you know, will sort of read two pages and, well, that's my reading done for the day, and once I'm in a world, I want to be in it.
Do you know, I think that I have mishandled my reading life, I would say, in the last, easily the last 20 years. And just not read enough. Simple as that. I have piles and piles and piles of books. There's a Japanese word for this. I remember finding out there is a Japanese word for books that are... Oh, I should have known it. And maybe you could find it out. For books that are there calling you, that you want to read. And that's my life. My life is full of working very hard, looking after three kids, doing various things that I have to do, and regarding reading as a pampering, as an indulgence that I rarely get to. And what I absolutely know, as well as I've grown older, my concentration is less. So I need to be on holiday officially, which I hardly ever do, or nobody around me over a whole weekend, which hardly ever happens. Oh, that's it. The name for it is Sundoku, spelled T-S-U-N-D-O-K-U. And that is acquiring reading materials, but letting them pile up in one's home without reading them. That's exactly what my life is like.
Oh, thank you.
There's a Japanese word for it. Imagine that.
Oh, I'm so relieved. No, it's not just me.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I envy you, because it sounds like you are still swimming in the lovely sea of literature regularly. And I am rarely. And yet it's my greatest desire. So I'm not denying myself the chance to do it. I just don't have the chance much. And then I think, well, I've got my life upside down. This is the wrong way round. And I suppose part of me is thinking, oh, you know, and this may be crazy thinking, but I'm thinking, right, I need to stop everything, really literally say, I've retired now, and spend the rest of my life reading all the books that I am longing to read. And I do have this strange thing in my life, which I'm absolutely sure you have, which is that I am sent books by people, and unbidden, to ask for me to quote on them or whatever. And so I feel a kind of great responsibility to read those, especially if they're by people I know. And they pile up, but I didn't ask for those. And yet there's my Sundoku pile that I, you know, really want to read. And so I have the great dilemma all the time of what I should be reading, what I'd like to read, and not having enough time to read at all.
It's so hard, isn't it? I think it reminds me a little bit of, you know, books you're made to read at school, which I think that's a very good thing. But the way that books sort of come into your life, and I'm sure as an author and a reader, when you get sent a book that you didn't ask for, there is a bit of you that's thinking, oh, I know this represents, you know, years of a person's life and everything, but also at the same time, I'm never going to, I don't know, finish. I think, you know, I've barely read any Dickens, and here I
that's
am
right.
with like 90
that's exactly
hot books
right.
of 2021.
But you can have wonderful surprises with it. I was recently sent Ruth Jones's book, her latest book, which is called Us Three. And I know Ruth very well, and she is a great writer for telly. But I didn't know her writing very well. And I thought, I ought to read this because Ruth sent it to me, and I know she wants a quote and blah, blah. And I slightly begrudged it for a minute. And then within a page, I didn't begrudge it at all. And I thought, do you know, I wouldn't know about this unless this was sent to me. And thank God. And I spent 2 days in her company and was delighted to be able to give her a quote. And so sometimes there's a happy accident like that.
Oh, that's really lovely. In your writing, does it feel different, writing for the screen versus writing to the page? Do you feel as though one is more instinctive than the other, or are they just sort of separate but equal?
Yes, that, exactly, I think, separate but equal. And I do believe that the writing I've done before I came to sit down and write fiction, certainly, has informed the way that my brain works. So I like to visualize everything, and lots of people tell me that when they read my books, they can see the scenes, and that delights me. That's great. It may mean that I'm not very literary or something, that I'm quite visual or quite kind of kinesthetic or something, but I don't mind that. My journey through learning to own my own writing voice, if you like, has been quite edifying, really, for me, because and I've learnt a lot, because I wrote my very first book, which was an autobiography, in revenge, really, or in anger, because somebody had written a book about me, an unauthorized biography, and it was very badly written, and it was a very odd experience because I felt as if I was bullied. So imagine somebody takes your life and rather carelessly writes, A, their opinion of you, which is anyone's entitled to, but B, cobbles together a kind of version of your life and your family without ever really talking to you or your family at all. And I suppose lots of biographies are written in this way, certainly of dead people, but, you know, you do a bit of research.
Yeah. I'm so sorry that happened, Dawn. I cannot imagine anything more invasive and exploitative.
It's completely awful to have this happen to you. And there are many, many little inaccuracies in this book, little factual inaccuracies. But of course, that adds up to a giant inaccurate book. And I'm kind of used to people writing inaccurate things about me. That happens all the time in the press. So I'm used to kind of going, oh, OK, I just have to live with that. Or, OK, I'll fight this one. But with this, some of these inaccuracies were about my family, you know, and I'm very ferociously protective of my family and my mother in particular, who was alive then. And this woman wrote that my parents had split up when they were younger and blah, blah, blah. And this had never happened. My mother was outraged, and my dad wasn't alive anymore. This was such an insult. So, you know, there was me. I had to go and get a high court injunction against this person who was also furtling about in my adopted daughter's life, trying to find out who her birth mother was, and, you know, calamitous things that in for the sake of a biography. And then what would happen is, because that was the only book about me that was for sale, I would go and do my gigs with Jennifer and people would bring this book to me to sign, because of course they didn't know that it's written by someone who doesn't know me and that it's full of dreadful untruths and that it's hurtful and damaging and harmful. So I used to take the book off them and give them 20 quid and I would spend all my money from doing the gig on trying to replace and explain to people. And I thought, okay, I can't keep doing this. So I wrote my own autobiography. And it was at that moment when I sat down again, slightly begrudging it, thinking, oh, treating it a bit like homework. You know that Sunday night feeling when you've got to hand your homework in on a Monday morning, dreadful, huge black cloud above you. I sat down like that thinking, I've got to write my own autobiography now because of this. And then I started, once I decided I would write it in the form of letters to everyone I know and love and those that I have fancied and those who've been my crushes and those who have actually been in my life and to my dead dad and so on. And once I decided that was my route through, oh, I loved it. I loved the time on my own. Everything I thought I wouldn't love because I've worked in such a collaborative way in my life, in groups and in partnerships. And I thought, oh, listen, look at me. I'm in a room on my own. I'm in my own head. I can control every sentence. I can choose every word. I know the story I want to tell. And that was where I suddenly realized, oh, I think I'm at home here. This I'm happy doing this. It pleases me and it was very fulfilling. And so when that autobiography was done, when Penguin came to me and asked me if I'd like to write fiction, I was there immediately. I was afraid, but I was there.
Oh, it makes me so happy that something so joyous can come out of something that was initially so shit.
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that. And I wouldn't wish to go through it again. But it was just in the end, you know, it was right.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Dawn soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. I was racking my brains for something that's kind of cosy and Christmassy and wintry, so I have chosen Diablo Cody's memoir, Candy Girl, A Year in the Life of an Unlikely Stripper. This is how it starts. Nobody comes to Minnesota to take their clothes off, at least as far as I know. Here in the woebegone upper country, Jack Frost is a liberal, rangy sadist with ice crystals in his soul patch. This is the author's bitingly funny account of what it was like to enter the sex industry and work in the strip clubs and peep shows of Minnesota. It was published in 2007, and I think that certainly in places it probably needs to be read as a period piece, but it's fast, funny, and so much fun. Candy Girl is published by Gotham Books. Now, back to Dawn.
This is it's not a question. It's one of those bad, like the Q&A at the end of the event. It's more of a statement, actually. But I did great, because I've always, you know, written and wanted to write and sort of, you know, scribbled different things down. And reading French and Saunders sketches was a huge part of that. I did that sort of as they were the books that I was pulling off the shelf and loving. And it was really, you know, reading your words and those that taught me how to write. And I think that the sort of, to be a really, I mean, I don't know that I am, but I think, you know, you absolutely are, to be a propulsive writer, to write what people want to read, and to have that sense of, you know, the language being really powerful, and to use it wisely and well, and sort of have economy. I'm not wild about books that are presented as being very, very, very literary. I was going to say, it's probably what your husband loves, because, like, you know, 5 pages on a tree, not for me, but clearly there is an audience for that.
There is, and there are people. I mean, I did write my second novel was called Oh Dear Sylvia, and the Sylvia was a V-I-A, and so it was a reference to a tree, because I was writing about a woodsman in there. So actually I was reading books about trees at that point, because I didn't know much about trees, and I read a lot of Robert McFarlane. So, you know, here's somebody interested in nature, but writes about nature as if it's living, human, breathing. So, you know, that was the good crossover for me, to find somebody who could write about cathedrals of trees. And I went and slept out overnight in a wood at his behest, because he said in one of his books, you know, everyone should do this once in their life, to listen to what a forest is like, and to feel it. And it was uncomfortable and it was cold, but I was able to write bits of this book because I did that. And he drew my attention to the moss, to the very small things, the details of the moss on the trees and the way the roots are and things like that. So there are writers who write in not such a practical way. Not that that would be my husband's way through it at all.
I know you've talked about not having as much time to read as you'd wish, but are there any books that you've read more than once, or books that you'd reread for comfort?
I don't think I've ever... I don't think I've ever reread a book properly from cover to cover. But there is a book I return to dip in and out of, and that is Stoner by John Williams. And now, I came late to this. I believe that this book, you know, people who knew about it, and then it was re-released, wasn't it, a few years back, and then that's where I came to it. Maybe it was about 15 years ago, I don't know. Somebody gave it to me, anyway, someone I love, and I thought, okay, I'll have a look at this. And, oh my goodness, this was just, I just ate it up. Here was beautiful, concise, clever writing about a very ordinary man. And that was the whole thing. Here's a man, William Stoner, who everybody has just overlooks, basically. He doesn't matter, not even to his own wife. Nobody notices him. He works in a university, you know, he's an academic. Nobody cares about him. No one can remember him very well. Even his leaving party is paltry. but his inner life, the inner life of this man was huge. So his interior was massive. And the detail of John Williams's writing is just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And that chimed with me, because I know that I can't write, you know, intricate crime drama. I can't do that. I'm no good at that kind of story. I'm interested in relationships between people and the massive seismic changes that can happen when something small happens, or when someone forgives someone, or when you meet a new person that ignites something in your interest, you know, when you chime with somebody else, when deep calls to deep in another person's character. And that's what that book is about. And I love it.
You've made me want to read it. For shame, I've not read it yet.
You've got a treat. You've got a treat in store. And there's no shame. That's the thing. There's no shame in not having read a book. There's only another adventure to have. There's only an excitement.
It's so true. Dawn, what I would love to do for Christmas is I'd love to give you a week where you can stop the clock. It's like Bernard's watch. You can just read, yes, and read and read, and no one needs you for anything for a week. That time is yours. What do you read?
Oh my goodness, I've got so many things stacked up that I want to read. I mean, at the moment I have a Peter Perfidi's book called Broken Greek sitting on my desk. I want to read that. I want to read Jessica Mitford's letters. Everything. And like you said, Dickens. I want to return to Dickens, which I don't think I've ever really properly read. My dad read some Dickens to me when I was young. He read Bleak House to me. And of course, you know, I've seen lots of films of Dickens, but I don't think I've never read A Christmas Carol. You know, that's what we need to be reading at Christmas, isn't it?
Mm. And I think I have read A Christmas Carol because it's very short.
Good. Tick. I definitely will read that.
I really, really loved the adaptation of David Copperfield. Was that the start of this year?
Yes. Well, funny you should say that, because I thought that's what you were going to say. Many years ago, I was in an adaptation for telly of David Copperfield, and Maggie Smith was in it, and the very young Daniel Harry Potter was in it.
Oh, really?
Daniel Radcliffe, yeah, he played the little chap in it. And I was just a boozy, you know, landlady, the favourite kinds. And that's the way I've got into Dickens, you know, via Miriam Margolyes, doing shows about Dickens and all the women from Dickens. When you think, oh, how hilarious.
You know, you think it's all about, like, you know, Miss Havisham and Estella. And I think they're sort of, like, really weird, you know, it's the sort of not strong women in the way that that's, you know, come to be sort of overused and I think a bit abused, is it? But strong women in that striking, mad, stay in your head forever, sort of subtly weird and then all out weird.
Yes. Well, that again is clever writing, when someone like Stella is someone where you think, well, that wouldn't happen. Well, I don't know anyone like that. That's crazy. That's surreal and odd. That's an eccentric, isn't it? And then you creep towards the metaphor of what it all stands for, or the meaning, or the, you're taken in and you feel, you know, you have a visceral connection with someone and you don't know what it is. Is it sadness? Is it memory? It's very haunting, you know, and so you allow yourself to be eaten up by the literature. And that is a treat, because it's not easy. You have to, you know, you conjoin with the writer and you agree. That's the contract, isn't it? You agree that you will lend your imagination and you will allow yourself to imagine who this person is. And then the writer's job is to fulfill that, you know. And I think also it's a writer's job to solve problems, if you like, as well, for you, but not to allow you to creep towards it somehow. I mean, at the centre of my book, of Because of You, I set out with a challenge to write a character who has done something so unforgivable, because it's not a spoiler, but she steals a baby. And, you know, that was my worst fear, that my thought that somebody could steal a baby. That's not okay. And there's nothing forgivable about that. But then I thought, well, that's why I'm going to choose that crime, because I then have to find a way to forgive this woman. So I have to write a character you can forgive, and I have to write another woman who perhaps can forgive her and why she can. So, you know, I think having a challenge like that, and I think Dickens definitely has that all the way through, the challenge of making you love this person. How can you love, oh, what were they called, the people that took Oliver in the
Undertakers? No, that's not what
I'm about. What were they, Mr. and Mrs. something, you know, who you just think, oh, do we know? Not sure you're that kind to Oliver. We don't think we love you. But then you know, you worm your way into it and you're involved, and now you love Oliver even more. You know, it's very clever, very clever. I've got a lot to learn.
But all of my favourite writing, and I think that's so, you know, in evidence in your novels, especially in Because of You, it's the emotional truth. And you've got, and you know the writer hasn't done the wicked thing or the mad thing or the terrifying thing, but they've really, really, really understood how it would feel, and they know exactly how they would feel.
Well, that is the joy of writing, is that you explore these difficult things that are not in your... It's fiction, after all. So, you know, you are imagining what it would be like to have your baby stolen. What on earth would it be like? What would that moment be like when that woman comes out of the bathroom, goes to the cot in a hospital room and sees just a blanket and no baby? And, you know, and I have to take myself to that place. And I suppose the actor in me can do that a bit. The improviser in me can do that a little bit. But it's actually just the human really, isn't it? You know, and I have to place myself, Dawn, in that character for a moment, and then I have to do sort of somehow wend my way to Anna's head rather than Dawn's head to find out what, you know, how would she cope with that moment? But what does it feel like to have a shock? And, you know, what do you feel in your throat? And what happens to your breathing? And what happens to the air in the room at the moment that you realise something so terrible has happened to you?
And I know you mentioned Ruth Jones' fabulous book, but I'd love to hear about any other books that have made you laugh. Do you laugh out loud ever when you read?
Yes, I do. I definitely do. The book that made me laugh the most was when I was younger. What was I, in my late 20s, I think early 30s, when I came across Pagoon by Spike Milligan. And it's a beautiful book about the partition of Ireland and how crazy it is when this one village spans the border. So certain things are allowed on the north of the village that are not allowed in the south of the village. And it's absurd and silly. But Spike Milligan peoples this village with very funny characters. And he also did something that I didn't even think was possible to do. And I know other writers have done this before, but I'm not well enough read to know about it. But he removes a character from the book, outside the book, to talk to you, the reader. And the character talks to the writer and admonishes him for not writing him well enough and for not including him in certain parts of it or not being clever enough. So there's a relationship between the writer and this funny little character that escapes from the pages, which you, the reader, witness. And you think, oh, okay, you can do that, can you? You can take somebody outside the pages who acknowledges that they're being written. You know, that is extraordinary. But that all the voices that Spike Milligan clearly, and again, here's a sketch writer, you know, here's a comedy writer. And because his voice was so clear in my head, he was somebody I laughed a lot with my family at when he was part of the Goons and so on. That when I read that book aloud, and then I had a boyfriend at the time who was Irish, so that helped. He read it aloud to me. We went on a holiday on a boat and we had a tilly lamp and we would read Pagoon in the evenings. And so I remember laughing very much to that.
I love that because it's such a shared and sort of disinhibiting thing, isn't it? When something, and I think Spike Milligan is just one of those writers where I've laughed so hard and got to a point where I've always forgotten why I was laughing in the first place. He's always strikes me being so much funnier than the sum of his parts, which I mean is a compliment.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's very poignant when you think of the battles he had with depression and so on. But so many people who live on the edge of their mood like that can dip into funniness in such a wonderful way. And his poetry, especially, you know, for children. If you've got young people coming around to your house, Spike Milligan poetry is hilarious and irreverent and, you know, includes farts and is delightful.
Always up for a fart joke. And I think it's so important because I don't read nearly as much poetry as I'd like to. And I always sort of think of it as being something quite serious and, you know, I've forgotten, you know, that it has a function. It's supposed to be for everyone to read and, you know, like singing songs together.
Yeah. Well, sometimes in poetry, I can find a couple of sentences that see me through a year or further, you know, that can become a little mantra. And sometimes you can forget the whole poem, but only remember little bits. And it helps to have chunky little moments. I mean, I keep a diary, and at the front of my diary, if I come across poetry that I like, and I will do it if I see something in a book, a great sentence in a book, I will also do it. But when I go back and reread it, the poetry, of course, has been delivered to you, especially in these chunks. You know, the words are so sparing and carefully chosen that they're the ones that I return to. For instance, there's an American poet called Jane Hirschfield, and she wrote a very small, I think it's three lines, the poem. And I remember reading it and thinking, okay, that's interesting. Let me read it again. And it goes like this. I'm going to have to try and remember it off the top of my head. It goes something like this. I might get a word or two wrong. I moved my chair into sun. I sat in the sun, the way hunger is moved when called fasting. So that's the poem. I moved my chair into sun, which I take to mean, you know, I moved my mind into a brighter place. I sat in the sun. I stayed there. I made sure I stayed there. The way hunger is moved when called fasting. In other words, we can decide how we regard anything. We can be in control of stuff in our lives rather than letting it control us. That's all it is. It's change your mind and stay there. Move yourself to a place. Now, in a year when I was going on tour and I had a terrible kind of vertigo that afflicted me throughout this tour, and unfortunately was triggered by the lights on the stage, so there's no way I could do the show and not have this problem. So I had months of touring with this terrible thing going on, which made me feel like I was drunk, but without the joy of the alcohol. And it disabled me in a very curious way, and it made me very sad, and it made me feel weak and vulnerable and all things that I don't ordinarily feel. This little mantra, I repeated to myself, like, you know, constantly. I would do it before I went on stage. I would do it when I was feeling low. And I'd think, yeah, I can change this. Okay, this is a thing that's happening to me, but it's not me. It's not what defines me. This is just something that I'm poorly with at the moment. And I will get through this. And I need to move my head from this dark place over there to the sun. And I need to sit there instead. And it genuinely changed me. And that's words from somebody else's heart, changed my heart and enabled me to cope with a difficult situation. And that's the power of poetry.
Isn't that magical? And I think that's so true and so wise. And it's an idea that I'm sort of new to this year. And there are writers that I'm loving a lot. When I was young and cynical and silly, I would be very quick to dismiss them, and finding a lot in Elizabeth Gilbert and Brené Brown especially. And that really...
Brené Brown! Oh, what a treat. She's a gift to us all. Elizabeth Gilbert, did you say? I don't know that person. I'm writing it down.
So she famously wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which I haven't read, but she
Ah, yes. I have not read that.
Big Magic is her book about writing, and it was so liberating. And my favourite Elizabeth Gilbert thing is her idea, and I think she actually talks about Brené Brown and says, as a writer, you can be a martyr or a trickster. And martyrs always have that Sunday night homework feeling that I know so well, and make a real meal of it. And I've done that for sure. I'm like, oh, I'm doing my very serious thing. No one talk to me. What was that? I said, don't talk to me. And that sort of... Whereas a trickster is like, this is hard and I hate it, so I'm going to creep up on it and sneak up on it and find a way of doing it that doesn't feel like doing it.
Yeah, it's a trick, but everything is, you know, a sort of fake it to make it thing. I've definitely done that in my life. I've thought, what would it be like to be a very experienced, successful, appreciated author? Let's start writing and see what that feels like. And I know I wasn't that, and I'm not that particularly, but I tried to see what that would... Well, maybe I am creeping towards that now, but, you know, I tried to see what that would feel like. And I think I've done that a lot in my life. I remember going to live in America after I left school, and I won a scholarship with the English Speaking Union to go and live in America. And I was very lucky to be... seconded to New York. So, you know, I arrived in New York age 18. I mean, you know, mad, really. And I thought it was the set of Kojak, you know, and I thought it was a dangerous and scary place. But of course, I fell in love with it. But when I was on the plane going to New York, I thought, oh, God, nobody knows me here. Nobody knows that I'm Dawn, who does that and that and that and has this fear and is a bit bossy about that or whatever. I thought, they don't know me, so I'm just going to pretend to be this like really collected person who's very in control and massively confident. And so I got off the plane as that, you know, and it was a bit of acting, really, faking it, because I wanted these people to receive me like the person I'd rather be than being as anxious as I was when I got on the plane. And weirdly, when people start to respond to you in that way, you think, yeah, I quite like this. And actually, I can do it. Not entirely. And you needed to stop the faking and somehow climb into your real clothes, which you can really wear, that really fit you, but that have the new confidence in. It's okay to do that. It was, yeah, that's remarkable.
It's like discovering you've got a superpower, isn't it? When you, that moment when you realise the world will take you at your own estimation, that people aren't sort of squinting at you, trying to mark you down.
No, that's right, yeah. Or also realising that people are not all your enemies and they're not trying to find fault. I've even had that experience with Jennifer, where we went on tour, and I remember the very first time we went on tour and we were about to go on stage in Glasgow, you know, which any comedian will tell you, you know, that's a baptism of fire there. But I remember thinking, oh, we're going to die. There's an audience and, oh, they're going to hate us. And what if they heckle us? And what will we do? Do we run? What do we do? And it was the minute I put my foot on the stage and we walked out, I thought, okay, well, of course, these people want to like us. They've paid money to come and see us. They're hoping that we might entertain them. So they're not our enemies. And this is not a battle. This we're all in this together, you know, and they're hoping for a great evening, and so are we. So it's okay.
That's so true. There are so many things that I always forget. We're all on the same team. It's not your driving test. I failed 3 driving tests, and I still can't do it. I was wondering whether, when you met Jennifer and that sort of early bonding, whether there were any books that you talked about that you both sort of shared or discovered that you had a mutual love of.
We are very different, Jennifer and I. We're kind of chalk and cheese. I say that, and then we have weird moments of synchronicity that are quite astonishing, really. We sometimes will turn up in the same shoes or the same car that we might have bought, you know, and it's exactly the same. And so we do have, there are moments where we're very, you know, similar, but mostly we're quite different. And she is not a fiction reader at all, really. Or she might occasionally, but not much. What she loves is autobiography. And she loves people. She loves reading about actual people. Whereas that wasn't my bag at all. Occasionally it would be, and then we would swap that. You know, she loves, for instance, the letters of, was it Mary Wordsworth, the sister? You know, she loves that kind of thing, real life letters, diaries, biographies. But then, of course, those things led to us trying to write characters that might be writing letters like that. You know, so her references were more useful than mine, really. But we didn't have much in common. I don't think there was much that we read together. That we didn't read. We were at college and we were busy doing, you know, we didn't read much at all, to my shame. No shame.
No shame. And I suppose it's really interesting, isn't it, that sometimes, you know, your perfect sort of writing partner and working partner is someone who's got a very different perspective and a very different set of references. Because also, when you are wanting to make sure that the thing you're referring to is sort of specific but also universal, and if you're both really immersed in the same world, no one's going to step out and say, oh, but if you've got no entry point, this makes no sense.
Yeah, that's true. And I'll tell you something that was hilarious, and I realized was so helpful, is that when Jennifer and I sat down to write sketches, you know, sometimes we'd set them in, I don't know, Elizabethan times, or we'd be cave women or whatever, you know, they'd be all over history, if you like. We realized that we really didn't know any history, or if we did, we had it all completely confused. We had all the wrong kings and queens. We just failed history, basically. So we would end up calling things the olden days. and that was anything from yesterday backwards. So when we wanted to write specific characters that were set in a specific time, do you know what we used as our reference? Ladybird books. The Ladybird Guide to the Tudors, or the Ladybird Guide to, I don't know, prehistoric Britain or whatever. That was it. You know, you've got 20 pages with illustrations that tell you the kind of buildings and what people were doing and who the king was and so on. That was it. Those were our references. They were brilliant. This was all before the internet, obviously.
That's fantastic. Because, I mean, the number of things I read that are sort of very dense and historical, and you do think, oh, this 20 pages on rough manufacturer does not serve the story. But you've gone away and you spent 6 months of your life researching this and you can't bear to leave it out. So I think maybe ladybird books are the answer. Nothing is extraneous.
No, that's right. That's right. And what a delight they are as well. You know, you realise that the child in you could still learn this, whereas the adult in you is so ashamed. There's that word again of what you don't know, and it's you mustn't reveal yourself to not know. And I think that's part of my resistance to writing anything historical at all. I just think, oh, giant research. And some people would love, Hilary Mantel loves that. Obviously, you love it. You know, it's something that some people relish. I like research. I like something to be authentic so that you then can break the rules if you need to. And for this particular book, actually, I had to research quite a lot, including going to see a heart specialist who I sat down with and said, I need a disease that serves this purpose. And I told him my story and how I needed it to fit in. I needed it to be hereditary, and I needed it to show up when you were young, and I needed it to exacerbate a situation when you're pregnant, you know, all of this. And I saw him sitting there going, okay, oh, it's not atrial fibrillation then, it's not that, it might be this, it might be that, I think I know what it is. So he called in another surgeon. You know, this is a man who's busy saving people's lives all day, and he's in his in his special gear, greens. And he sat down with me, and we had about half an hour on this particular disease. And he was getting very juiced up and interested in it. Called in another surgeon. He said, what she's looking for is something like this. Would it be that? Would it be this? Would it be that? And they were going through it, their little, you know, index of all the diseases that might suit. And anyway, he eventually gave me one, and he sent me lots of information about it. And I went and researched it a little bit more. And I thought, yes, this is my disease. Great. Perfect. This is perfect for my purposes. Went off and wrote it into my book. And bear in mind, I write longhand with a pencil on lined paper. So once it's confined to the page, it's pretty, you know, I don't like to have to change it too much. I'm happy to do that in a big second draft. But anyway, I laced it into my story. And then he sent me a different disease. He just thought of a better one.
Oh!
He was obviously still thinking about it. And he came up with one. He said, oh, Dawn, sorry about this, but I've just, you know, I've been giving it some thought. This would be better. This would serve your purposes better. What about this? And I thought, grr. Now I've got to make sure it's that disease instead of this one. So that's the kind of research I like. But I, you know, I like real human beings that can talk to you rather than wading through great big tomes of, you know, reference. The same was true. I had to find a registrar of births, deaths and marriages who would tell me what a moment might be like if a mother of a stillborn comes in to register that. And I also had to say to her, how would my character get away with not having a birth certificate? How could you break the rules? So she really enjoyed thinking about how to commit a crime using her particular skill set. You know, it's good fun. I mean, obviously, I thank them all in the book, but that's the kind of research I like with real people. I went down to Trelisk Hospital and talked to the midwives there, and they furnished me with all kinds of wonderful stories.
Are there any books with really great food scenes or meal scenes? Coming up to Christmas is very much on my mind. Any dinners you would love to have been a part of in a book?
Do you know, I was thinking about this, and I'm not sure there's exactly a scene I can remember, although, again, you know, when we think about Dickens and seeing sort of cornucopias of bacchanalian things dripping on tables, or even, like you say, you know, with Stella, the things dusty and still there. I was thinking about all of that, not particularly cheerful, but instead of a particular scene, I would say this book, which is The Debt to Pleasure by John Lanchester. This is an amazing book when it comes to food, because he has written a hilarious snob called Tarquin Winnott, who is a sort of food critic, but who is the most massively pompous man, pretentious as all hell. He writes and writes his own recipes, discusses other people's recipes, goes to restaurants and does, critiques and reviews of stuff, and is just unbearable as a person. So he has written a book with this delicious character in the middle of it. But everything in this book is about food. So I'm sorry it's not a one little scene, but it's a whole book. And this book is a delight.
That's fantastic, because that's so much bang for your buck, or for my buck. And I've not read that book and I can't wait to read it. That sounds thrilling.
Yeah.
Are there any books that you've not talked about, or that I've not asked you about, you'd like to talk about?
Yes, there is a book I do want to mention, which is when you were talking about rereading, which I'm very bad at, but I do dip in. And there is a book that I have dipped into often in my life, and I wanted to mention that. And I have to look at the title because it's a complicated title. It's a John Berger book, and you will know that John Berger wrote Ways of Seeing and all of those books. And they're little and manageable and relatable and connect to your heart, but help you look at things properly. I mean, he's an art critic and, well, he has many things. He's a philosopher, really, as much as anything. But I would recommend, of all of his books, a book called And Our Faces, My Heart, Brief as Photos. And it's a series of small little essays. And they are just utterly, utterly beautiful. And I don't know this life that he has. He lives in France sometimes, or he's died now, sadly. But he was a friend of my friend Simon McBurney, who pointed me towards this book. And it lives in my house, and I give it to people all the time. It's by my loo, it's by my bed, it's on my office desk. I have several copies of it, and sometimes I just go straight back into it because it's a little injection of utter beauty.
Is there a particular essay in the book or a passage that really speaks to you?
There is, and I don't have it here with me, but it's about seeing this beautiful flower. And because he writes about looking at stuff, he's sitting in a kitchen. Really, it's about love. It's about his girlfriend and the beauty of her. And he's sitting in a kitchen and he's looking out, and he realises that there's a mirror, and he can see the back of a plant, of a flower. Is it an iris? Is it a dahlia? I can't remember now what it is. And he sees the back of it. And that's what he's looking at. And he thinks that's unusual. And he describes it. And then he realises that he's looking at the back of it and how much more beautiful the back of it is than the front. And he makes that a sort of metaphor for his admiration of his beautiful girlfriend and how the back of her, so to speak, is everything. And never mind, the front is also beautiful, and the front's what everybody else sees, but the back is gorgeous. And that essay, and I wish I could tell you the title of it, I can't remember it, is gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Huge thanks to Dawn. Do tune in to see her as Beatrix Potter on Sky One on Christmas Eve. And if you haven't read it already, I could not recommend her new novel, Because of You, more. It will make you smile, and most importantly, it will make you feel so much closer to the people you love, even if you can't be with them right now. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at YBooked, and if you've enjoyed this episode, it would really make my day if you could leave us a 5-star review. It's the best way to help new listeners to find the podcast. You can find a list of all of the books Dawn talked about at acast.com/booked. Finally, I leave you with this from Jeanette Winterson. Most kids grow up leaving something out for Santa at Christmas time when he comes down the chimney. I used to make presents for the four horsemen of the apocalypse. See you next time.
We are so thankful.
That's the sound of Elisa getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be providing a refrigerator for her foster youth and filling it with food. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a fuel-efficient Honda, like the 2024 Accord Hybrid. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.